And because we have such a wide umbrella, it's providing more protection for holders of economically valuable rights that might not have been protected before the Constitution. If the state takes these rights and takes the substance of these rights, the state must compensate. But at the same time, it needs to be done for a public purpose or in the public interest. And obviously, that's a much easier requirement to meet in respect of land. And it is obviously a bit more difficult to think of examples where you could expropriate non-property other than land for public purpose. Obviously, there might be a case we want to nationalize certain companies and take those shares, potentially for public purpose. But, or maybe when we're dealing with intellectual property, a patent in certain medicine might be expropriated for public purpose. But it's very unlikely that the public purpose requirement could ever be met for the state taking your copyright in a book you wrote. So again, it's wide because the definition in the Constitution is wide, and the Constitution allows the expropriation of anything considered constitutional property. But again, when you move away from land, the public purpose, public interest requirement really operates as a brake on what rights the state can just expropriate.
Thank you. Thanks. I would probably...
Prof, yes. My apologies. Are you going? Because we're supposed to be receiving the presentation from the department now.
I just want to check the thing.
Are you going to remain? Because I suspect some of the questions could be answered by the department.
I think we there are about 5 unanswered questions here. I don't think we are invited to the next part of the meeting. I think that part is closed. But we are more than happy to return and have another conversation with you about the... And we are also very happy to take questions in the meantime around which we can prepare answers for you.
But even responding to them, inviting them and sending them to either Dr. Anik or the committee secretary will quite appreciate that. But this will be with us, we'll quite appreciate that. Because committee meetings are open to the public. So if you have time, you can remain in the meeting, and then we invite the department to present, and probably some of the questions they will be able to respond to them. But we'll appreciate it if we can even send those response in writing.
We can do our best to do so. It might take a little bit longer to receive it in writing, but we'll try. Thank you very much, colleagues, again, for giving us an opportunity to engage with you. I'm sorry that we couldn't get to all the very, very good questions. It gives us more reason to do this research and to continue working on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doc. Professor,
Tim? Chairperson, I'm sorry to do this, but my two questions that were very important were about to be answered. I understand if they can be answered in writing, but if I can just please, it's extremely important, Chairperson, The second to last question, I did ask about the constitutionality, but I'm sure that the professor, the doctor, Mr. Matiba can comment on that. But the most important thing is the landowner or the owner of the property that now has to go to court and incur massive costs to defend their possession. What protection is there for them in that regard, if there is any? And then the other question I'd just like the panel to consider, and please respond in writing, and obviously if they can respond as soon as possible, is... Are there any examples of in the past expropriation since the passing of this act originally in 1975, I think, of expropriation of intangible assets? In other words, intellectual property, businesses, et cetera, are there any examples of that, and how were they dealt? Maybe they include that in their research. The chair, I'm very concerned about the onus placed on the simple, maybe not well-resourced landowner that is bonded up to the hilt, who does not have the hundreds of thousands and maybe the millions to go to court and defend against a department who has all the resources in the world? That's a very important question, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim, for your indulgence. Commissioner Perry, can you put the Part B agenda on the screen?
Yes, Chair, I'm doing so.
Thank you. Thank you, colleagues. Again, just before passing, just a word of gratitude to the professor and her team for the brilliant work that was done in terms of laying the conceptual framework for us to understand where the concept expropriation comes from, where to locate it within the broader process of private property, public property. How did it evolve? What are the processes that has to be involved in terms of stages that has to be involved before you expropriate? What is it that can be expropriated? Who can be expropriated? You helped us create a deal for that. And again, on behalf of the Select Committee, a sincere word of gratitude to your effort in honoring our invite. Thank you a lot, Prof. Members, we will now move to the second leg, which is the briefing on the expropriation bill by the Department of Public Works. We understand that the minister has joined us. Greetings to you, Minister. Indeed, we welcome you.
Thank you.
We will invite you to take the platform because we have already welcomed other members of the team from provinces and members of the committee. The floor is yours, Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson.
And compliment of the news is to you.
yes, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I will first of all ask permission to put up my video. As you can see, the screen is not very good. So thank you for that. Chairperson, I am joined today by six officials from my department and also by Advocate Uday Naidu that has been working with the committee since the inception of the bill. Chairperson, I would just like to make three introductory remarks before I ask Advocate Naidu to come in and do our presentation. And I want to deal first of all with the historical context of the bill, why the bill is needed, and lastly I would like to share with the Standing Committee a current case study for expropriation for the public good, public purpose, or public interest, whatever we want to call it. My first point, Honourable Chairperson and members, is that expropriation is not unique to South Africa. The abilities of governments to acquire or expropriate land for the public good, it is something found worldwide. We have presented this bill as part of our consultation, Honourable Members and Chair, also to all the ambassadors and high commissioners based in South Africa. This power of governments, of a local government, provincial government, national government, to take property for public use, exists, for example, in the United States of America, the UK, New Zealand, Australia, South Korea, and Africa. We're talking about Ethiopia, Rwanda, Brazil, and many other countries. And our constitution expressly authorizes expropriation to redress the injustices of the past. So these powers of expropriation is called different names in different countries. In the United States of America, they use the term called eminent domain. India and Singapore, it's referred to as land acquisition, because expropriation is another form of acquisition. And also in the UK and New Zealand and Ireland, it's called compulsory purchase. And so you can go on to Canada, Russia, to Brazil. Most of the Western countries, these powers are referred to as expropriation. Now, why the bill is needed? The bill is part of the government's comprehensive approach to land reform and redressing spatial inequality and improving access to services and opportunities. So the government is committed to restitution, to redistribution and land tenure, as was recommended by the Presidential Advisory Panel in 2019. We also see, Honourable Chairperson, that this bill will bring certainty to South Africans and investors, because it clearly outlines how expropriation can be done and on what basis. So this legislative certainty is critical as we rebuild our economy and we invest in our community. The existing Expropriation Act dates back to 1975. The Presidential Advisory Panel pointed out that this 1975 Act is inconsistent with the Constitution, and the correction of this has been long delayed. The panel also pointed out that the 1975 Act undermines the constitutionally enshrined principles of lawful, procedural fair, and a reasonable administrative justice. So that is why the bill is needed. But one of the cornerstones of this proposed legislation is that the holders of unregistered rights in property must be treated on an equal and procedurally fair basis in the expropriation of such property. Also, and I'm making this point deliberately because of the fear-mongering in our country about expropriation. All South Africans are equally protected in the Bill of Rights in Chapter 2 under Section 38 of the Bill of Rights. So I want to share with you quickly, Chairperson, just to illustrate using the existing 1975 Act, that the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure, we're being requested by ESCOM to expropriate servitudes in terms of the existing legislation for electricity transmission lines on its behalf to allow the entity to supply more power to areas in Limpopo than what is currently possible. ESCOM needs to strengthen the electricity network by upgrading the existing substations to increase the capacity of power transmission. And this will also allow ESCOM to provide more electricity in Limpopo for the public interest, the public good, and the public purpose. So we have been using and helping ESCOM with the expropriation of the servitudes. It was done in terms of Section 3 of the Act 63 of 1975, but read together with Regulation Act 4 of 2006, the electricity regulations for expropriation on behalf of a licensee. Now, what did we experience here, Chairperson? That the design and the route of the required power lines crosses over state-owned property and privately owned land. So some privately owned land is affected by the design of the new power lines. And Eskom has stated that the servitudes and the new power lines do not impose detrimental effects in respect of these properties, which cannot be addressed by a reasonable compensation to private owners, and Eskom is willing to pay. So what happened is that the property owners who did not enter into servitude agreements were notified by the state's intention to expropriate in terms of the 1975 Act. And they've been served with the necessary expropriation notices. The property owners were informed in the expropriation notices that the date of expropriation is the 31st of January 2023. And that expropriated rights will be exercised by Eskom on the 1st of February. We are currently in the 60 days process whereby if the owners have received this expropriation notices, they must revert to the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure with the required information, the amount claimed by the owner as compensation, and how much of that amount represents the amount contemplated in Section 12(1)(b) of the 1975 Act, and other details that is necessary. This illustrates, Chairperson and Honourable Members, that the energy crisis requires all of us to work together for the greater good of our country, such as ensuring that the provision of the necessary infrastructure to enhance electricity supply is met. And I can present, if members are interested, exactly the process that we have followed in terms of 1975 Act. I also want to wish the committee well, Honourable Chairperson, with all your consultations. I know that you're consulting wide, and we have presented this bill to the National Assembly, and it was passed by the National Assembly, but we certainly look forward to work together with the NCOP Select Committee and Advocate Naidu for any new ideas that might come out in the consultation process of the NCOP. I thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Members.
Thank you, Honourable Minister, for the opening remarks. I guess Advocate Naidu is taking the centre stage now. Thank you, Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members of the committee. Thank you, Minister and members of the department, for inviting me here. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. I had submitted to the department a few weeks ago a memorandum for presentation to the NCOP Select Committee dealing with the bill, an overview of the bill, and some select topics for discussion and consideration. I trust that the committee has had an opportunity to read that document, and the committee may well have recognized some themes that our esteemed academics picked up on during their discussions. I don't intend to repeat much of what they've said. The purpose of this discussion is to give the committee an overview of the bill, the process of the bill, and some of the key variables under the bill. I do, however, think, based on the questions that members have asked, that it would be worthwhile spending some time dealing with those points towards the second half of my presentation today. I think that particular topics that require further discussion would be the definition of property, the application of the bill to transfers to third parties, the definition of public purpose and public interest as the substantive justifications for an expropriation, and the difficult position that mortgagees might find themselves in, and the remedies that the bill provides for them. These are very important practical issues that I would like to touch on during the course of my oral presentation. To start, we've already been told that this bill is intended to be acted pursuant.
Maybe if Enrico or Kipera can just share that memo on the screen so that at least as we speak, members must be able to see what we are talking to. Enrico, can you share that memo?
Thank you, Chair. We have given Advocate Naidu the presenting rights. He can share on his part.
Oh, I see. Chairperson, I find that because this is rather a long document, all in black and white, it's not very animated, it might be better for me simply to speak to the committee about the issues and let them read the document in their own time, if that's okay. All right with you.
No, that's fine. I'll get guidance from the members where they need intervention. Thank you.
All right. So this bill is really designed, as the other presenters have explained, to be enacted pursuant to Section 25 of the Constitution, as opposed to old order legislation, which has to be contorted and interpreted in a way to best fit Section 25 of the Constitution. And so the point is to design a bill which fits seamlessly with Section 25. This is an important theme, the symmetry between Section 25 and the bill. This has implications for the way in which property has been defined and the way in which public purpose and public interest have been defined. Let me go directly to that question. Property in the bill is defined as property in terms of Section 25 of the Constitution. One of the doctor earlier on likened it to a circular definition, and indeed it is circular. But there's a purpose behind that. It was done deliberately because the Constitutional Court has warned time and time again that it would be inadvisable to define property in a way that stonewalls it. From the time the Constitutional Court has been established to now, it has constantly expanded on the meaning of constitutional property. And so the idea behind defining property in the bill, as it has been, is to ensure that as the courts develop the notion of constitutional property, the bill always keeps track of that concept. There will be no asymmetry between property under the bill and property under Section 25 of the Constitution. Now, of course, as the doctor said, that doesn't necessarily mean that all property is up for grabs, because there are conditions on the exercise of the power to expropriate property. The primary consideration, the substantive justification for taking property from a private individual is that it must be used for public purpose or in the public interest. That's the first point. So that constrains, narrows down which kinds of property are going to be considered for expropriation. The second consideration, which the doctor mentioned, is that the property must be capable of state acquisition. The state must itself be able to take the property. And of course, if the state created the property itself, for example, a permit, taking the property for use by the state would be a misnomer. And so property that cannot be acquired for state use for public purpose or in the public interest would also fall outside the set of property that is reasonably contemplated under the expropriation bill. Of course, we know what the purpose of the bill is. It's not just to acquire property for public purpose to use for the public benefit or by the public. Another important purpose is also land reform. This is a pressing need and a constitutionally required measure for the state to undertake to bring about redress of past injustice, particularly proprietary injustice. What the bill intends to do is to facilitate the transfer of private property to particular individuals for land reform purposes to bring about equitable access to the nation's resources. That is something mandated in Section 25 of the Constitution itself. These types of transfers are different from expropriations generally in that they will not, the property is not acquired by the state, one, and two, the property won't be used by the public generally. It will be for the benefit of a particular individual for a constitutionally authorized purpose, land reform. In the bill, when it was before the Portfolio Committee in the NA, we had raised a drafting issue with the application of the bill insofar as it related to the transfer of property to third parties. Unfortunately, that issue still remains, but it is an issue which this committee can and should deal with. If I could take the committee, please, to the definition of expropriation in the bill, the committee will find it at page 5. This definition comes straight from a judgment of the Constitutional Court in a decision called Agri-SA. Expropriation means the compulsory acquisition of property by an expropriating authority. So the state itself must take the property, and what the state acquires must either be the same or substantially similar to the rights that have been taken. The purpose must be for public purpose or in the public interest. Additionally, an organ of state which requests property for a public purpose can ask an expropriating authority to expropriate that property for it, for the organ of state. What the committee will notice is that the definition of expropriation does not contemplate direct transfers to individual third parties. It contemplates only acquisition by the state or an organ of state through an expropriating authority. And that's because that's what the Constitutional Court has defined expropriation to be. So as to give effect to the purpose of land reform, what the department recommended to the Portfolio Committee was to include in the application clause, clause 2 under the bill, a provision which ensured that third-party transfers in the public interest would be governed by the protections and the mechanisms under the bill. The clause that we proposed essentially said that the provisions of this Act will apply to transfers of property to a third party in the public interest with the necessary changes required by the context. And so in that way, we wanted to account for the fullness of public interest and public purpose transfers. Unfortunately, the committee did not accept that proposal. I'm not so certain of the reasons why, but it does leave a gap in the statutory framework, which I think this committee needs to address. We have written an opinion on it before, and that may be made available subject to what my principal instructs. Turning back to page 5, what is a public purpose for the purposes of this Act? Previously, the concepts of public interest and public purpose were undefined in terms of legislation. Courts interpreted those two variables to mean different things. Sometimes there was consistency, and sometimes there wasn't. The Honourable Member, I think, from Gauteng raised a question about who defines the public purpose and the public interest. Well, happily, the bill seeks to do just that. In a later amendment to the bill, the Portfolio Committee accepted the Department's suggestion to define public purpose in the following way. A public purpose includes any purposes connected to the administration of any law by an organ of state, in terms of which the property concerned will be used by or for the benefit of the public. So, to answer the member's question, who determines what is a public purpose? Parliament does when Parliament enacts legislation. Provincial legislatures can do so when they act provincial legislation. And municipal councils can do so when they pass bylaws dealing with expropriatory matters. So there is a democratic element which comes into play when one defines what a public purpose is. Going back to the definition of a public purpose, the purpose must be set out in an empowering law. Let's take an example. Let's say we're dealing with an Education Act. The power to expropriate will be exercised for the purposes of building a new school or extending the property on which an existing school is so that there can be a boarding house. The minister responsible for administering that particular statute, or the MEC, which is more correctly the case, can use the power to expropriate only for the limited purpose defined in the Education Act, which will be for educational purposes. That would be a public purpose under the expropriation bill. In exercising that power, in order to exercise that power consistently with this Act, the object needs to be use by the public of that particular property or use in an indirect sense for the public benefit. So let's say this is a public school. If the MEC expropriates the land next door to build a boarding facility, the public, those people who attend the school, will be able to use that land directly once a boarding house has been built. What about indirect purposes? Let's say the Department of Public Works has been asked by the Department of Education to acquire land or building for it so that it can run its offices from the building. It doesn't need to pay exorbitant amounts of rental to a private owner. It instead will have the benefit of publicly owned property. If the minister is satisfied that the Department of Education needs that building for its housing requirements, the minister will be exercising her expropriation powers for a public purpose, namely to provide housing to another government department for it to fulfill its mandate. Now, the public doesn't use that building directly. The building is used by a government agency. But the use of that building by a government agency benefits the public indirectly. All those purposes would have to be defined in legislation itself. The bill creates a substantive power for the minister to expropriate property, but it doesn't exclusively regulate the field. There are other pieces of legislation which the professor identified which empower other organs of state, members of the executive or functionaries, whatever the case may be, to expropriate property for the purposes as defined in those empowering statutes. So, to answer the question as far as public purpose is concerned, the public purposes will be defined by the lawgivers. Public interest is different. Public interest means something different from public purpose, but it hasn't been exhaustively defined by the courts. What the Constitution says is that the public interest includes the nation's commitment to land reform, reforms to bring about equitable access to natural resources, and to redress the results of past discriminatory laws or practices. That's just part of the public interest. The public interest may go beyond that. But we don't know what the additional content is. The courts haven't yet defined it. And it would be inadvisable for Parliament, in passing this legislation, unnaturally to constrain the meaning of public interest, where constraining the meaning might result in asymmetry with the public interest as envisaged in the Constitution. Remember I spoke about symmetry when it came to the definition of property? Well, exactly the same thing applies when we think about public interest. What we can say about public interest on an interpretation of the bill itself is that it doesn't include the public purpose. The expropriation of particular property may serve both a public purpose and a public interest, but these two variables mean something different. Public purpose is defined in empowering legislation which is administered by an organ of state, or expropriating property for use by the public or for a public benefit. Whereas public interest would cover everything else contemplated under the Constitution. May I pause at this point to ask for any questions of clarity, Chair? Because I think it is an important point.
Thank you, Advocate. Just want to check with the honourable members whether they have any other questions to pose to Advocate Naidu. How far are you, Advocate?
I understand that I'm meant to end by 12:15. I would say okay. I need another 10 or 15 right. minutes, if that's in order.
All right. Why don't we run until you are done, and then we invite questions from after you're done, and then request honorable members to note their questions. The reason why I'm raising this is because 2 o'clock is budget speech, and I suspect members might want to get into the budget speech and probably prepare themselves before that. Yeah, let's ask members to do their questions, and then we can then just finish your presentation and we'll pose questions.
Thank you, Chair. This is a very rich and detailed bill, and there will be lots of questions, I'm sure. But for present purposes, let me give an overview of some of the continue with the overview of some of the key points. We've covered third-party transfers, the definition of property, the definition of public purpose, public interest. What I'd like to move on to is what is a topic of concern for many. How is the amount of compensation calculated? Compensation is a particularly important aspect of any decision to expropriate. But it isn't the justification for the expropriation itself. It's a consequence of a decision to expropriate. The decision to expropriate must be taken based primarily on whether the acquisition of the property will serve the public purpose or be in the public interest. Whether the state will decide to expropriate the property will depend on the suitability of the property. One of the considerations in determining whether the property is suitable would be the amount of compensation that would need to be paid for that property. The amount of compensation needs to be just and equitable, and it needs to reflect an equitable balance between the public interest and the interests of those who will be affected by the expropriation, if the expropriation is in fact proceeded with. The bill was revised to reorder the sequencing of events so that instead of determining compensation after the decision to expropriate was taken, the analysis of what the just and equitable compensation would be was brought forward so that it would inform the question of whether to expropriate at all. And the committee accepted this. The issue I would like to flag for the committee's consideration is how Section 12 has been formulated in the bill. The particular part of Section 12, Clause 12.1 that I'd like the committee to focus on is on page 13. Now, if the committee compares Clause 12.1 to Section 25.3 of the Constitution, which is quoted in the preamble, there's a notable difference. The Constitution, as I've mentioned, requires the amount of compensation to reflect an equitable balance between the public interest and the interest of all those who may be affected by the expropriation. Whereas Clause 12.1 requires the amount of compensation to reflect an equitable balance between the public interest and the interests of expropriated owners and expropriated holders. Now, there are two points that arise from this. The first is that expropriated owners and expropriated holders are just two examples of all those who might be affected by an expropriation. At this point, I'd just like to footnote the interests of mortgagees. The second point is that expropriated owner or expropriated holder are referred to someone who has already been expropriated. But because the order in which we consider whether it would be, whether it would serve a public interest or be for public purpose to expropriate altogether requires a consideration of the amount of compensation that might, that would be payable, it could never consider the interest, it would always have to consider the interest of someone who is yet to be expropriated. So it would never be in the past tense, it would have to be in the potential future tense. And that is an important matter, because when the committee was reordering the sequence of events, unfortunately it neglected to pick up this change, necessary change in tense. And the change in tense was important because it does reflect the reordering of the sequence of events and the considerations that need to inform the decision to expropriate. There is, of course, one instance in which the amount of compensation will be considered after the decision to expropriate has been taken, and that's when property is expropriated in an emergency. The emergency provisions are now contained in Clause 20, Urgent Expropriations. There, the circumstances require property to be taken at once and for compensation to be determined as soon as reasonably possible, but within 30 days. Only in that case would the public interest need to be balanced against the interests of an expropriated owner or expropriated holder. But as a general point of departure under the bill, it would always be balanced against someone who is yet to be expropriated. I footnoted the interests of mortgagees in this part of the discussion because it ties into the concern raised by one of the members. I believe it was one of the members of the official opposition. What is the position of mortgagees under the bill? A mortgagee is someone who holds a limited real right in property to secure a loan. The person who receives the loan puts up their property as that real security. The person who holds the bond would usually be the bank. So the person who is considered for expropriation, the owner of the property, is someone whose property is subject to a mortgage and who owes money to the bank. The concern was raised that if the property is expropriated, what then happens to the obligations to service the loan? And what happens to the obligations or to the rights to receive payment without the benefit of real security? The bill addresses this. If an expropriating authority is going to consider all relevant factors to inform the decision whether to expropriate, the existence of a real right of security over the property in favor of a bank or any other bondholder would be a very relevant consideration. This is something an expropriating authority would need to bear in mind in determining whether it should expropriate the property. If the expropriating authority considers this and finds that the property is suitable for expropriation, in principle, it must invite representations from the mortgagee, that is the bank. The bank will then be in a position to tell the expropriating authority what the outstanding amount is on the loan, potentially what the risk profile is of the customer, any relevant information that would be necessary for the expropriating authority to consider. If the property is expropriated, as part of that analysis, the expropriating authority will then need to consider how much compensation would be just and equitable in order to satisfy the outstanding portion of the loan so as not to leave an expropriated owner in a position where they will be worse off, because that would be very seldom be just and equitable. So the amount outstanding on the bond would reasonably be expected to be considered in any analysis of what the just and equitable amount of compensation would be. If the property is going to be expropriated and the property is subject to a mortgage, the bill makes provision for a mechanism to ensure that the expropriated owner and mortgagee are able to address their own contractual relationship, their bond relationship, so that neither party is left worse off. The particular provision is Clause 16, and what it provides for is a mechanism where the expropriating authority can pay out the amount of compensation only if there is agreement between the person who has been expropriated and the mortgagee. The agreement is for them to negotiate and is intended to serve the purpose of settling the owner's liability to the mortgagee. Once agreement has been reached, the expropriating authority will then pay out the money to the person whom the parties have agreed will receive that money. That's Clause 16.1. If there is a dispute between the mortgagee and the owner as to how much money is owed, and the expropriating authority doesn't want to become embroiled in that dispute, the expropriating authority can deposit the money with the Master of the High Court, and once the dispute between the two private parties has been resolved, the Master will make a payment to whichever party the amount is owed to. So in that way, the bill seeks to protect a mortgagee who would have lost the benefit of the mortgage, protect the commercial interests of that mortgagee by creating a mechanism that's designed to ensure that the mortgagee will receive payment on the outstanding portion of the loan. You see, when property is if property is subject to a mortgage and the property is expropriated, the expropriating authority doesn't also acquire the mortgage. The mortgage is tied to the principal debt. And if the property is no longer in the ownership of the person who is the debtor, then the mortgage is meaningless. The expropriating authority doesn't acquire the mortgage because the mortgage can't be separated from the principal debt. So when the property is expropriated, the mortgage is terminated. It becomes valueless. And that has implications for the mortgagee, the bank. So clause 16 seeks to ameliorate that loss of security by guaranteeing some managed payment mechanism for outstanding debts on properties. There is one more issue I'd like to canvass, and I understand that my time is running out, and that is something I noticed last night when I was preparing. There was a provision in the bill which allowed a person who was about to be or was considered for expropriation an opportunity to make a counteroffer to the expropriating authority in response to a notice of intention to expropriate. That provision has since been removed from the bill. What happens now is that after receiving a notice of intention to expropriate, the recipient must decide whether she accepts the amount of compensation or will dispute the amount of compensation. If that person disputes the amount of compensation, that person no longer has the ability to make a counteroffer. Instead, the dispute resolution provisions would kick in, and the parties must either mediate or go to court. And I wonder whether that is necessarily the best way to go about this, because if mediation or a resort to court is the only way in which a counteroffer can be considered or proposed, then it would be in the context of dispute resolution only that the expropriating authority can ever consider a counterproposal. It wouldn't have had the opportunity to consider a counterproposal before initiating a dispute. And I think perhaps there may be some benefit in revisiting that, because if agreement can be reached based on a counteroffer, there wouldn't be the need to rush to court or to convene a mediation. Chair, I have run out of time. There are a few other matters that are addressed towards the end of the written notes that I've prepared in paragraphs 32 and 33. I'll invite the committee to consider those matters, and I am very happy to make myself available for further discussions on these quite tricky points.
Thank you, Mr. Genadi, for taking us through the department's presentation. What I will then do, I will then invite honorable members to engage with the presentation. I've noted honorable Bratislav. The floor is yours, honorable Bratislav. Then it will be followed by honorable Dango.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I'm glad to report that my power is back on, so I can speak to you with my camera on and not from the car. Thank you to Advocate Nava's presentation. It was very thoughtful and well presented. However, there are still some issues I need to address, Chairperson, and I do understand that today we're really trying to jam a lot into 4 hours. There's a lot of discussion in this, but I know that our process will be lengthy on this matter. But, you know, like yourself, Chairperson, I've also had my smattering of legal studies, and I do remember in my second year law of contract, our professor, the first question we were asked, I think it was Professor Reinecker, said to us, what is the point of a good contract? And I remember it went around the class asking, and people were saying to regulate the terms between the parties and various other things. And he told us that we were all wrong, because the point of a good contract is to avoid litigation. And so I think that we need to start at that point. Any bill should be looked at is, what is the potential for litigation bill? And then I think that's always a good acid test about the quality of a bill. And I'm concerned that this bill opens up many areas of possible litigation. So to start there, and to go into the question I asked the academic panel earlier, and perhaps Advocate Uday can ask, Advocate Naidu can assist us, is where is the protection for the simple owner of property that may well be asset rich, but may well be cash poor, when a behemoth like the government comes along and says, right, we want to expropriate your property? What protection is there for such a person or business interest or whatever to defend themselves and come up with the resources to defend such an action? Is there any protection whatsoever in that regard? Then I come back to the issue around intangible assets. Now, I understand all the concepts around, immovable and movable property rights and intangible assets and intellectual property and all that sort of thing. And it was spoken that it would be very unusual for a government to expropriate something like intellectual property, something like business rights, something like a car, something like the glasses that you're wearing right now, Chairperson. But if there is no intention to expropriate movable and intangible assets, why not exclude them from the bill? I'm concerned about if we look at the Asian tiger model, where the government arbitrarily came in and told people, we want you to repurpose your business from what it's currently doing to something else. Or where in some countries that have gone the socialist model, just arrived and expropriated businesses because they felt that they would be in the public interest. I'm very, very concerned about if that kind of expropriation is not even contemplated, it's extremely unusual. Why on earth have it in such a wide definition in the bill? Why open the door for that type of expropriation? Because when you look at public interest, the definition of public interest that Advocate Naidu covered, public purpose, but public interest specifically says whatever the commitment of the country at the time is towards, and it specifically says land reform. So it specifies there that public interest is about land reform. But interestingly enough, it says natural resources. Now, natural resources I understand to be land, water, minerals. Why on earth do you want to include intangible and movable assets under natural resources? How can intellectual property be a natural resource? Which is that's the definition stated under public interest. So that's, if we can just get responses on that. And then under Section 12, Section 12C says that the preamble to Section 12, subsection 2, says that the expropriating authority must not take into account a number of things. And one of the things that does not be taken into account is consideration of enhancements. So if somebody has bought a property, has improved the value of the property by building buildings on it or whatever they've done to improve the value of the property, that must not be taken into account by the expropriating authority, which would be completely unfair because it would open the holder of the property to a loss. Effectively, it would mean that they've overcapitalized on the property. And then also Section 12(3A) says that you must look at the use of the property and whether or not there are any plans to develop it. Now, the point is, Chairperson, in the South African property market, people sometimes buy pieces of property for the purposes of speculation. They may not have plans to develop it, but it is their right to buy them and perhaps sell them later at a profit. Now, the minister earlier said that this bill would provide certainty to investors, but if investors have to consider if they're purchasing land for the purpose of allowing it to improve in value and sell it later, they would be dissuaded from doing so. And also, if they consider that I might own a piece of land in South Africa, but I may be exposed to massive litigation costs to defend my rights in that regard if the government just starts along and expropriates it, because we have such a wide public interest clause, which includes all property and not just land, that might well dissuade investment in property. And so these are the questions I just wanted to raise with Advocate Naidu, and I do understand it's a lot. So if Advocate Naidu cannot respond completely now, I fully understand that, but perhaps we could get written responses if he can't cover it all. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Tim. And Robert Dango?
Thank you very much. Minister, let me remind you and myself of District 6, of Friederdorp, of Sophia Town, of Clarewood, and other places where people were expropriated by the National Party government and they had moved into negative equity. Now, the question I'm posing now is really, I go back to the Salt River project of the Khoi and the San people. Who's going to be compensated in that issue with the Amazon development? If that expropriation takes place, and this needs to be given back to the people that were dispossessed originally, when there was no records, when there was no land register, when it was collective ownership, where is the question of negative equity in that one for those people that were expropriated in 1652. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Dango, for those questions. Let me just check as to whether are there any other members that would want to engage. Maybe just one to two questions from my side. The section 12C. Am I correct, advocate, to say that that section 12C makes provision for nil compensation? And that it also makes provision for nil compensation to take place in a situation of where they come to the conclusion that it is just inequitable use nil compensation if it is in the public interest, but also where there's an element of unlawfulness that was detected. Let me just read to that section 12C so that at least there is no confusion around that, but it makes reference to unlawfulness. I just want to read that section. Section 12C to section 12C. It says he talks to, I think, yeah, he talks to he talks to the he talks to compensation. So I just want to get a sense as to whether does am I correct to say that he does make provision for that. The second point that I want to ask is there no contradiction between just an equitable and the mean compensation? And what happens where there is no agreement, because the act of the bill also makes provision for expropriation even before payment is made. But also the other question that I want to pose relates to the public interest will be land reform and land distribution, and is the bill at the center of it, those two aspects, considering the fact that that has been a topical issue, because we all agree that the fall of the subsistence farming in our country, whether we like it or not, was linked to the legislation that was passed from the 1880s, the first legislative measure that led to the fall of the South African peasant was the Cape Parliament in the Cape Parliament under the premiership of Cecil John Rhodes of the notorious Ten Grey Act in 1894. This was followed by the Union of South Africa in 1910, where some of the provisions of the Ten Grey Act were incorporated in the Native Land Act of 1913, because this act prohibited Africans to buy land and own land outside the 7% of the land that was reserved for their occupation. So the question is, the public support and public interest, which mainly will be then reformed, does it take into account the fact that there is a need for land distribution and land reform, because in most cases we are where we are because of this history. I think also just the last point, I think one of the authors have also in 1972 has argued that the development of mining capital in South Africa in particular was inextricably linked with the reserves, so-called subsistence and informal economy that has been referred to, which to another degree also meant that you will have an established right commercial farming on one side, and on the other side you will have a disintegrated rural economy in the form of understand. So that at the center of the exploration bill, does it take into account land distribution and land reform? Thank you. Over to you, Advocate. if some of the questions I've often said to give to the minister, if the minister is still on the platform.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the honourable members. Chairperson, you first identified the answer to Mr. Rantisset's question concerning section 12, I beg your pardon, clause 12.2c of the bill. Clause 12.2c of the bill excludes only unlawful improvements on the property from being considered in the amount of just and equitable compensation. So lawful enhancements would not be hit by 12.2. Right, so that takes care of that. As to the protection of a private property owner against the behemoth of the state, well, litigation is perilous, and litigating against an organ of state exercising a public power has those very features, and so the courts have developed particular rules to assist parties in a vulnerable position when trying to challenge the exercise of state power. The bill itself doesn't provide for things like funding mechanisms or legal aid. Other pieces of legislation do that. But what the bill has done to assist people who may be expropriated and want to challenge that decision is to ensure that the decision to expropriate cannot be taken in the ordinary course until after the amount of compensation has been agreed or decided or approved of by court. So it's only after the process has run that course and the amount of compensation has been agreed on or determined that a decision to expropriate can be taken. Once that decision to expropriate has been taken, and if it has been taken affirmatively, and the owner or the expropriated owner wants to challenge that decision, it will then be open for them to go to court. Sequencing it in this way is important, because after an amount of compensation has been determined by a court, it would be open for an expropriating authority to decide, actually, I don't want this property. I don't want to pay that much. And so I'm not going to expropriate it. So there may no longer be a need for the subject to challenge that decision. So the way in which the bill assists the subject is not by providing mechanisms or means for challenging decisions to expropriate, such as funding or other resources. What it does is sets out a process so that all relevant information is before the decision maker to make an informed decision. And if the decision is taken, which is adverse to the subject, and the subject wants to challenge that decision, the bill guarantees the subject a pathway to the courts in clause 19.6 to approach a court on any matter relating to the application of this act. But the bill does not provide for measures to assist a challenger financially. That's not the purview of the bill. There are other pieces of legislation and other organs of state like the Legal Aid Board, which would serve that function. Intangible assets. The Honourable Member did refer to some movable property like a car, which could be expropriated, and questioned whether it should ever be expropriated. I recall one of the academics, the doctor, listing cars in the category of movable property that could be expropriated, and I think that's correct. In the event of an emergency, it may be necessary for government to requisition vehicles. to move people from flood areas or whatever the case may be. So I don't think cars are necessarily off the list. But intangible property does pose some interesting questions. Property is increasingly becoming dematerialized. We deal with things like bitcoins and shares and I suppose one can commodify your Instagram account or whatever the case may be. And those would still be assets and intangible property, arguably intangible property recognized under the Constitution. Just because something is intangible property doesn't mean that it will necessarily be expropriated or even be suitable for expropriation, because it may never be capable of serving a public purpose or being in the public interest. So going back to what the doctor said earlier on, if one looks at the definition of expropriate, or rather the power to expropriate in the Constitution and the riders on that power, one can, by process of interpretation, eliminate certain kinds of property as a matter of practicality from the scope of the Act. There may well be a need to expropriate immovable property. I can't prognosticate now as to what that need might be. There may be, but that isn't the point. The point is that the bill shouldn't be under-inclusive lest it exposes itself to constitutional challenge on that basis. Let's say that there is, I'm trying to think of a counterfactual, let's say there is a need for the state to acquire a company which has become a monopoly in an industry. There's an old example in Canadian law, I think it's Manitoba versus, there was a Crown corporation which effectively had a monopoly on fishing. And the Crown Corporation, by act of the legislature, vested those rights exclusively in the state. So the state effectively acquired a monopoly on fishing. And that was considered an expropriatory act. But it was done for public benefit. It could be done in our country because there may be a monopoly abuse of a certain industry. And it may be abuse in a manner that impacts very negatively on large swathes of the public. Government may want to step in to expropriate, and of course that will be a policy question whether it does. From a legal perspective, the bill shouldn't too hastily crowd out those prospects to make it impossible to expropriate if the circumstances so require. I didn't quite understand the member's question about trying to rely on the public interest definition in clause 25. Of the Constitution to justify expropriation of intangible property. The first point is that public interest is not exhaustively defined in section 25(4)(a). It includes the nation's commitment to land reform, reforms to bring about equitable access to natural resources, and an intangible asset wouldn't be a natural resource. I accept that. It might not be related to land reform. But even if it is neither of those things, it may be notionally possible for intangible property to fall under the remainder of public interest as a variable. The remainder which is undefined in the Constitution, because what is defined is purely included and not an exhaustive list. It is probably more likely that if intangible property were expropriated, it would be in terms of legislation which would tightly define the nature of the property and the purpose of the expropriation. And so the expropriation is more likely to be a public purpose expropriation than a public interest expropriation. The only distinction I can think of off the cuff of my head is where intangible property is expropriated for the benefit of it or and for use of a third party, and a direct transfer is made rather than a transfer via the state. So I'm going to have to give this some thought, but as a matter of principle, my answer would be that I don't think the bill should crowd out the room for expropriating intangible property, given how quickly the use of intangible property has permeated our lives and will continue to do so. I think increasingly people will start holding more intangible property than tangible property, and one wouldn't want to tie the state's hands unnecessarily or unduly if expropriating that property could serve a public interest or be for a public purpose. On the matter of expropriation for no compensation, I accept that there are some people who are property investors who will want to hold property for purely speculative purposes and to benefit from the appreciation in value of the property, nothing more. The bill isn't intended to target those people. What the bill in section 12.3a is intending to target is the use of property that could serve a productive social potential, but which is lying fallow and isn't being used by the owner, and the greater good, the greater public good, would be served by making that asset work for the public. And expropriation is the mechanism to acquire the asset for that purpose. I think one always has to bear in mind that the purpose requirements, the public interest, public purpose requirements, drive the lens through the suitability of any particular property for expropriation. So the example that we were given of a private property owner holding assets for purely speculative purposes, where those assets wouldn't serve a public purpose or be in the public interest if expropriated, doesn't present a controversy. I hope I've answered the members' questions. And if I haven't, then chaired through you, I'm happy to provide a written note.
Thank you, Advocate. I hope that members are happy with the responses that you have given to the questions that they have given. And
one more point I wanted to raise, which is in response to you, a question which you raised about whether expropriation can occur before the payment of compensation. Yes, expropriation can occur before the payment of compensation in the ordinary course, but the right to acquire possession of the property will vest in the expropriating authority only after compensation has been paid, never before. So an expropriated owner of property won't lose his house and won't lose his house without any compensation, to put it crudely. The only instance in which, under urgent expropriations, the duty to pay compensation after expropriation is spelled out in the bill, and it must be paid within 30 days, as soon as reasonably possible and within 30 days. Chair, I believe there's a question.
Is it still necessary to talk about expropriated owner, not an expropriatee? How can you become an owner when your property has been expropriated? Let me get to another question. Tim, Madam Ambassador?
Yeah, Chairperson, look, I appreciate the advocate Nadu's responses. I don't think they get to the nub of the matter and all, but I do appreciate where he did assist. I'd just like to remind the committee of the relatively recent example of Zimbabwe, where farms were expropriated because their government felt it was in public interest to do so. And that crippled that country's agrarian economy. Because one may look at a farm and say there are many fields here that are not being used, they're lying fallow, but of course they may be intended for future rotational use. And I'm just very, very concerned that the advocate says this is not controversial. Land that is lying fallow may have future use and not necessarily used right now. And I just think that we should really be mindful of our northern example as to how we can destroy an economy through this purpose. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Tim, for that. Advocate?
Thank you, Chair. I wouldn't want to tread in the realm of policy. That's not my field of expertise.
Okay. Right. Then I think let's... Then,
Chairperson, that's a very good lawyer answer. Well done, advocate.
Yeah, let's then take this opportunity to defer to the minister if he's still on the platform. Minister, any last words from you?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you for all the questions, and also to Advocate Naidu. Honourable Chair and members, we will be on standby for any further engagements with the Portfolio Committee. We know that this is also work in progress, and we will be there to assist with any other further explanations. I do wish to request the committee to consider the clauses Advocate Naidu made a reference to, because even though it's passed the National Assembly, the NCOP Select Committee presents us with an opportunity to reconsider those clauses. And I hope that the committee will consider the proposals from the department while the bill is now processing through the NCOP. So once again, thank you for the opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Minister, for that. Let's then check with Dr. Aniki in terms of the process plan, just before we go to the in-house.
Sorry, Chairperson.
Yes, Tim?
Chairperson, thank you for indulging, Chairperson. The Minister's made a very good point. Advocate Pillay did point out some of the clauses that he was concerned about. Is it possible to get a document from Advocate Pillay so that we can take those into consideration? And I do appreciate the Minister's willingness to improve the Act even in the NCOP state.
I think that's a good point that the team will work on. Doctor Anita, can you just outline the I think let's probably then finish this and then we'll then below the minute. But I think what is quite critical is that following this, then definitely we'll be waiting for the engagement at the level of the legislatures, the briefing of the legislatures, but more than that, I think we'll then allow that public hearing exercise to take place, and then we will then, when we are ready, as the committee, then deal with the report. But members must be ready to be part of the briefing at their respective provinces. Let me take this opportunity to thank the minister and the team for the work that they've done, honoring our invite and also briefing the select committee on this expropriation bill. We'll definitely take the hand extended to us as a committee. Usually when the briefing takes place at the level of provinces, we expect the team to be able to send their reps so that they make it much more easier for us in terms of briefing to help us. So we are humbled by that pressure, and then also take this opportunity to thank members of the public for attending, members of the media, the committee staff for the attendance. What we will then do, we will then deal with the next items on the agenda, which is the minutes of the previous meeting. But the team, they are free to excuse us because we are now dealing with the in-house issues. The minutes. Thank you. Can we deal with the minutes, Doctor?
Yes, Chair. I'll see you in a moment.
All right.
Chair. Member McCarthy, I'm not too sure if we're allowed to sit or can you also be excused?
No. You are free to exit, Member McCarthy.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. We are dealing with the minutes of the... You're gone again. just check here. We have three sets of minutes that we must adopt. Yeah, the first minute is that the minutes of the 30th of November 2022, where we are hosting the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. Those are the attendees that attended the meeting. Can we go down? Can you go down, Dr. Clark? Your screen is not moving.
I'm moving on my side.
Okay. On our side, it's not moving.
Do members see point number 4 at the moment?
No, we're still at attendance at the briefing by the panel, right at the top.
Let me try to stop and see again.
Yes. Can you move up? Are you moving?
Yes. Can members see movement?
There's no movement. Or am I the only one? Let me check with other members.
It's not moving,
Chairperson.
Where's Enrico?
Okay, I'm gonna screen it from my side quickly.
Thank you very much, Enrico.
Okay, Enrico.
Actually, while Enrico was busy bringing up the minutes, I just wanted to confirm to you that 15th of March is the date for when the permanent delegates will brief the respective provinces on the bill. Members would have seen that the adverts for the bill as for input on the bill has gone out. We are currently sitting on over 10,000 submissions today. So so we've received a lot of input on the poll so far. I just want to give that feedback.
Yeah, the 15th of March. Okay, beautiful.
Yes.
Good. Thank you. So members will be in their respective provinces to bring the to bring the provinces.
That's correct.
Thank you. Now let's move and before that is the 30th of November, where we dealt with the Praza. Is the attendees okay? All right. Those are our guests, and then the opening remarks. As the overview, any correction on that? And the comments and deliberations? We have an outstanding date with Praza in Cape Town. I think our next meeting, we must go and see the central line. I think that's what we must do, because we were informed that there is tremendous progress on that. Any correction, members? In the absence of any correction, can you then get a mover for the adoption of the minutes? So through reflection?
I so move, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Dango, for moving. Can you get a second there?
Second, Honorable Chairperson, thank you.
Thank you, Mshwari. Can we get to the next set of minutes? The minutes are duly adopted. Suspect it will be planning and monitoring. We had two meetings that day. It was in the morning and in the afternoon. So in the afternoon we were hosting Department of Monitoring, Planning and Evaluation. Those are members that were present. Committee staff. Those are the open remarks that were made. Apologies. Those were the issues that were raised, and then comments and deliberations by members. And then the request that were made, can you just go up a bit? Can you just go up a bit? Yes, this is a request that we made, report on investigation into irregular appointment related to the period between the 1st of April 2018 and the 1st of March 2020, a report on its assessment of progress towards attainment of the NDP targets as identified during the Department's Media and Tech Strategy Framework. Let's get feedback whether we have received to this. You can give us a feedback next week when we meet. Those are the minutes that were adopted. And then the oversight report that we dealt with. Now we have to end up spending routine with self-purchase.
It was processed.
Thank you, Honorable Mas. Any in the absence of any correction or addition, let's get a move for the adoption of the minutes.
Yes, okay.
Can we get a move, Honorable Aplere?
Okay.
Thank you very much. I move to adopt the minutes.
Thank you, Honorable Aplere. Can we get a second there?
I'll second the chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Dango. The minutes are duly adopted on the 30th of November, the 2022. The next set of minutes will be the minutes of the 8th of February, 2023, where we hosted the Department of Transport in the briefing on the economic regulation of Transport Bill. Those are the members that were present. These are the members that were present. The guests here that were in attendance and also our team from the committee. Those were the issues that were raised. The briefing was by Advocate Mashaya, the team. Those are the issues that they raised in terms of the Single Transport Economic Regulator, the Regulation of Transport Bill, Implementation Plan, Organizational Design, and also steps that will be followed. And those are the observations, comments, and deliberations that were made by members. Can we get a move of the adoption of the minutes of the 8th of February?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I move for adoption of the minutes.
Thank you, Honorable Moshori. Can you have Honorable Aplani? Where's Tim? Tim, can you second? You are there.
Chair, I'm happy to second.
Thank you, Honorable Bratislav, for seconding. Honorable members, the minutes therefore are duly adopted. And then, is there any update, Doctor, on the overseas trip or study tour?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Soon after our meeting in November, we liaised with Delco in relation to the study tour. So the request went out to both England and Germany to as part of the study tour. England has come back favourably. We are at the stage now where we are busy with England discussing the thematic areas to be covered as part of the study tour. Germany's response, however, Chairperson, is that they're not able to host us at the moment for a number of reasons. They are at that time also hosting the Defence Committee for study visits. It's the Easter holidays and the Bundesrat is not in session at that time as well. There's also some financial implications that they asked us to consider. They then suggested, Chair, that the alternative is to come and visit them to visit Germany between 22nd and the 26th of May. On our side, that creates some uncertainty, Chair. Firstly, we don't know what the parliamentary program will be like at that time. And both committees are busy dealing with legislation that we will have to prioritize over that period. So we have gone back to England to ask if we were to extend the stay in England and then include visits to projects outside of London, if they would be able to incorporate that in their planning for the study visit work. And so we are still waiting on a firm response from them in respect of the extended visit, Chairperson. So at the moment, just to confirm, the proposed date was that 3 to 6 April in England, 11 or 14 was intended for Germany, but now we've asked England if we can then just extend the stay to include 11th to 14th of April in England as well, Chairperson. I'd be comfortable, and if I might, if we give England out till probably the end of this week, and then we'll follow up again in respect of the proposal for the extended stay in England. Yes, I'm happy to hear the committee's feeling on that.
In fact, the United Kingdom and not England. So we'd be extending the stay to either Scotland and Wales and other areas. The British ambassador has indicated that he will assist in any way that he can if we contact him for assistance. I know that the officials can't do that, but if they want to, I can reach out to him and say, please assist. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador, for that gesture.
Chairperson, my question to Anneke is, if when she says 3 to, did she say 2 to 6 April? And if that is the case, is the third when we would leave, or the third when we would be in England? Well, what would the date of departure be? It's just important to myself and I think my colleagues, Jaco Lont and Sonia Boshoff.
If I may, Chief?
Yes, sir.
Yes, apologies, Member Wood. It says 3 to 6 will be when we are in England. So we are, the planned departure would be the 1st of April
2023.
Okay.
1st of April?
Yes.
1st of April, okay. Well, that is the date that we'll be leaving, okay.
Yes,
Chairperson, you may have seen in the media, Chairperson, but that is the date of our federal congress. It starts on that day, so that might exclude maybe to the maybe Ambassador Dangle will be very happy, but it could then exclude my staff, Honourable Boshoff and Honourable Lund. I don't know if it's possible to trip backward a bit into April, but yeah, that would be very very problematic for us if the committee would like to have full representation. I suppose it's not out of our hands now.
I think that's reasonable. Let's allow the team to in planning to factor those factors into consideration, and probably in our next meeting we'll get a feedback.
Yes, thank you,
thank you, Doc. That the last point, just to update the members, one of our members, as you all remember, had to undergo an operation which did take place successfully. So he's at home recuperating, so we are with him in our prayers. Very soon will be joining us. Thank you, honourable members. I believe that we have exhausted our agenda, Doctor.
That's correct, Chairperson.
Thank you. Let me then take this opportunity to lead a tender word of gratitude to all of you, honourable members, and also our staff for the job well done. It was a marathon. But because of the support that we have from the management team, we were able to pull it off. but also to our guests from the provincial legislatures, the PMG, our legal advisors from the legal department. Your presence indeed is appreciated. Your assistance is well received. And on that note, honourable members, the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.
I will email her as soon as my laptop is charged again.